Museum of the Air. 9 p.m. Saturday. 9 p.m. Saturday.
Hi, this is Steve Williams.
And I'm Earl Douglas.
Asking you to join us every other Friday night for Strange Vibrations from the Hardcore from midnight until 3 a.m.
We'll give the best in alternative black music and toss in black rock classics as well.
That's Strange Vibrations from the Hardcore. 3 hours of the best in alternative black music Friday night, alternating with the Midnight Ravers. Heard only on listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. And it's just about 10 o'clock here on radio station WBAI in New York. It's Wednesday night. Time for Off the Hook. Sometimes it's good to hear the whole theme, don't you think? This is Emmanuel Goldstein. The program is Off the Hook. We're back after 2 weeks of absence, after the marathon, after all the excitement and fun, and ready to start anew here as we begin February with more talk of telecommunications, computers, justice, injustice, progress, regression, and various other things along those lines. A lot happening. A lot going on, a lot to update you on, and of course we'll be taking phone calls in just a little bit. A lot of people have been asking about Fiber Optic, who has been co-hosting this program for the past couple of years, and he has been sent to prison for a year and a day. We will be giving out his address a little bit later on in the program. We will also be hearing from him. So stay tuned, and you can find out for yourself exactly how things are going along those particular lines. Well, we have all kinds of prison news as well, which we'll be getting to as well. Something that I thought was pretty interesting came in the mail this week concerning the future of the phone system. The phone system is changing. It's not too obvious to us right now, but in the next year or so, the phone system will be changing pretty dramatically. Phone numbers will... Not local numbers so much, but area codes will be changing their format. And what that means is we'll no longer have to have a 1 or a 0 as the middle number of an area code. Now, if you look at any area code now, you'll see that they all have 1s or 0s, whether it's area code 800-212-718-908. They're all filling that particular regulation. And that was made for a number of reasons, the most obvious being that that was the way that primitive switching equipment would be able to tell whether a call was long distance or not. That and the leading one in front of a 10-digit number would tell you that as well. Well, January 1st, 1995, that all changes. And 3-digit area codes can be any number you want. Well, not any number you want, but any number the phone companies decide upon. In fact, there's already a few that are going to be starting up early next year, including 360 for part of Washington State, and 520 for Arizona, and 334 for Alabama. So there's three right there. Also, there's going to be a 456 area code, and what that is going to be used for, it's going to be rather interesting. It's not going to be used within this country. It's going to be used outside of the country for people calling in. It's kind of unclear as to what exactly it's going to be used for. I suspect it's going to be something along the lines of USA Direct, where people would prefix 456 in front of another number, and they would be connected to some operator of their choice. We're getting documentation on this. We'll learn more about it as the weeks go by. But that's the news as far as how that is going to be changing. Phone numbers will basically keep the same format. However, you may see an increase in the number of times where you have to dial a full 10-digit phone number. It's going to be a very interesting period of time, and I think the effect that we'll have in the end is that we'll have 10-digit numbers, no longer 7-digit numbers, and area codes will be passed out all over the place. There's more changes, too, as far as dialing, and this has to do with carrier identification codes. Now, a lot of us know what carrier identification codes are, but even more of us don't. And despite the efforts of some phone companies to get this information out to the public, it hasn't really gotten out all that much, and a lot of people don't really understand what it's all about. And I think most of our listeners know what a carrier identification code is, right? It's that 5-digit code that you dial to get another phone company or to route a call on another telephone company. For instance, AT&T. You would dial 10288, and you would get, you wouldn't get anything if you dialed just that. You would have to dial either a zero after that or a full phone number, and then you would get the call routed over that particular line. Now, how many people really know this? Let's find out before we go any further. Let's find out if, why not pick on our local 9X operator just because they're there and see if they know how to get Sprint.
9X.
Wow.
Miss Smith, may I help you?
Yes, hi. I need to know what the carrier access code is for for Sprint.
333.
All right, how would I dial that?
Excuse me?
I would just dial 333?
Well, I'll transfer you, and then you can ask them how to dial it, okay?
Okay.
Hold on just a minute.
Okay, fine. No point doing too much.
One moment for a long-distance operator who can assist
you. What's her name? Miss? Weird.
Sprint, this is Nate. May I help you?
Yes, hi. I just want to know what the carrier access code is for Sprint.
1033. If you were dialing directly and billing to your home phone?
Yes.
1033-31.
1033-31.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for dialing Sprint.
All right. Oh, boy. Okay, technically he's right, but he is confusing a lot of people by saying it like that. He said 1033-31. What he is actually saying is 10333 and then 1 plus, okay, because you would dial 1 before the area code. But, I mean, this is not the way they're advertising it. This is not the way this. I mean, that might be his personal way of giving out the number. All right, let's try the same thing with MCI, see what we get on that. Whoops. Dialed the wrong number. Okay, we're going to try to get the same information for MCI, see how hard that is.
9X.
It's inspirational, isn't it?
Can I help you?
Hi, I need to know the carrier access code for MCI, please.
Okay, I'm going to connect you with them, and they'll tell you how to reach them in the future.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Simple 5-digit number, but...
One moment for a long-distance operator who can assist you.
This is more fun, isn't it?
Sprint, this is Charles. May I help you?
Yes, hi. I thought you were MCI, actually.
I'm Sprint. One of the reasons MCI callers have been defaulting to us is because of a major major line down in the MCI system. So
really, what can you tell us about that? That's
well, I believe, from what I gather, there was a fiber cut in Michigan, which has affected service as far away as New York.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Weird. Another fiber got cut, huh?
Yes, sir.
Do they know who did it?
That I don't know. That's all I know. And and some of their operators have been referring their customers to other sources until they get the problem corrected.
I see.
Were you trying to use a phone card, or what were you trying to do?
No, I was just trying to find out what the carrier access code was for MCI.
Oh, it's 102220.
Okay. All right, thank you so much.
All right, then. Thank you for
the
sprint.
Now, was that the same guy? Did we get the same guy twice? Because, I mean, he put the zero at the end now. Oh, this is crazy. This is an indication of how nutso the whole phone system is. Cable splits and weird access codes. All right, look, this is how it works. The carrier access code for Sprint is 10333. Simple, okay? If you want to dial an operator, you dial 10333 and then dial 0 to get the operator. If you want to dial a long-distance call, you dial 10333 and then the phone number, which might consist of 1+, might not, depending on where you are. For MCI, the exact same thing, except you replace the carrier access code with 10222 instead of 10333. And for AT&T, you do 10288, and there's all kinds of other ones as well. It's very simple. It's too bad your local operator can't tell you that, save all this fuss. But the important part about this whole story is that system isn't going to be in use much longer. That's right, that system, the end is in sight. The end is near. And you know what's going to be replaced by? Well, they're running out of numbers, if you can believe that. I don't know where all these numbers are going, but they are running out of numbers. And they've decided that instead of using 3 digits like they use now, the 1 and the 0 are always there. So it's 10222, 10333. Instead of using 3 digits, they'd like to use 4. So they're going to change it. And instead of dialing 10XXX, you ready? You're going to be dialing 101XXXX. That's right. They're adding not one, but 2 digits to the whole dialing sequence. 101XXXX. That's before the phone call even gets started. Now, can you imagine the confusion that's going to reign in the operator rooms when they try to give this information out, when they haven't even mastered a simple 5-digit code? They're going to have to give out a 7-digit code now. It's unbelievable. And I don't really know where all these numbers are being assigned, because I only can give out maybe 6 different carrier access codes off the top of my head. I don't know where all the others are. So you may very well hear someday somebody explaining the nice, simple way to dial using AT&T, and they'll say something like, dial 1010-ATT 1-212-279-3400. Write a letter. A lot easier. A lot less frustrating. So that's going to be happening probably in the next year. That's right, probably in the next year that is going to be happening, because they're running out of numbers. 101XXXX. Okay. Now, something else, another indication of growth, which I think is a much healthier indication, and that's the Internet. The Internet is growing like crazy. And I'm looking at a newsletter here called Matrix News. And they tell you basically how fast the Internet is growing and what is anticipated. Well, they say the Internet Domain Survey of July 1993 shows 79% growth in Internet hosts in the year from July 1992, as discussed in Global Growth Rates, The Matrix and the Internet, which is an article in this particular newsletter. The October 1993 report shows 81% growth in hosts and 55% growth in domains from October 1992 to October 1993. There's all kinds of different surveys. Some show 110% growth, some show 65%, some show 59%. It's basically varying depending on how you measure it, on what your particular sources are. But I think everybody agrees it's growing pretty quickly. The city of Austin, Texas, is ranked first among cities in the United States for economic growth for an annual rate of 12%. Among nations, China is showing a similar growth rate of 12-13%. And astounding economists by doing so. Compared to that level, a sustained growth rate of even 65% is remarkable. Well, the internet is pretty remarkable, and it continues to grow. And we'll be seeing more evidence of that. Now, something interesting happened on the internet about a week or so ago. And that was when 2600 had its first internet meeting. Yes, that's right, the first virtual meeting of hackers around the world. Actually, it's not entirely true, because hackers, of course, are meeting on the internet constantly. But this was the first time that 2600 magazine jumped in and decided to have a meeting online to see what would happen. Well, it was crazy. It was absolute mayhem and bedlam and all kinds of things like that, because whenever you plan something like this out, things are always going to go wrong. And that's, we couldn't have planned it better. That's exactly what happened. Basically, IRC is a program that runs on the internet. It's called Internet Relay Chat. It allows people to link in from around the planet. If you have access to IRC and you can jack into the net, as it were, then you can talk to people that have done the same thing no matter where they are. And that was the idea behind this meeting, to get people on a particular day, and the day will always be on the 26th of the month, to get those people to be able to communicate with each other regardless of geographic boundaries or anything like that. And, of course, we don't have to judge people based on what they look like, what they sound like, just on what they type and whatever name they happen to use. So that was the idea behind it. Now, to do this, you have to set up a particular area, an agreed-upon meeting space. And that agreed-upon meeting space was the channel called 2600, and that's where everybody was instructed to show up anytime between, I believe it was 12 noon, and whenever we decided to end the thing. And so that involves a bit of planning as far as, well, getting the room ready, sort of. You have to make sure that that channel is there, that that channel has not been taken by somebody else, that there's things for people to do when they get to the channel. You can't just have, anarchy when people check in. There has to be some semblance of order. But this is the internet, and there is no real semblance of order. Things kind of fall into chaos many times, but the chaos is not necessarily a bad thing, which is one of the things that we learned on that particular day. 12 o'clock came round, and what happened? The machine that we were running, our computerized programs known as bots from, had crashed the night before, had crashed good for the first time in many months. It was down for several hours, and of course we weren't able to get things ready on time. So noon rolled around, and that was just about the time the machine was coming back online. There were about, I'd say about 50 or so people already in the channel, which was kind of crazy, because the way we had planned it so that we'd open the channel at a particular time, but people just sort of found a way to open the channel on their own, and they were just sort of waiting for the rest of us when we finally showed up, which was all fine and good, but it was complete chaos, as I said. We had no idea what was going on. We didn't have access to the programs we wanted to run. And so that slowly started to change. We started to get access to the programs as that system, which had crashed, started to come back up. And then we had an amazing turnout at the very beginning, within the first hour. I'd say at one particular point in time, there were 140 people on the same channel at the same time. And I don't know if you've ever talked to 140 people at once on the screen. It was you didn't know what to expect. Of course, you can send private messages to people, and they're not seen by everybody. But having 140 people to deal with was really a job. But, you know, that combined with the 1,000 or so people that checked in over the next 18 hours, it worked out incredibly well. There's this semblance of order that somehow takes over. It's just kind of, I don't know, an instinct of some sort. People migrate to other places. They make their own rooms, and they go into those, and they talk to people they want to talk to. They leave, they come back. And things never really did go wrong in the worst-case scenario. The network didn't break. The channel wasn't taken over by evil people that were going to push their own propaganda or say bad things about hackers or things like that. Never happened. People just came in, and much like any other hacker meeting, they just communicated. It was nice, and hopefully that will work out even better in the future on the 26th of every month. We're going to try to do it so that whenever it's the 26th, anywhere in the world, the meeting is actually happening. In other words, wherever the day actually begins, which I guess is somewhere in Asia, Japan perhaps, When it's midnight on the 26th, that is when the meeting will officially start, and when it's when the 27th begins in the last possible place, which I guess would be Guam or something, then that's when the meeting will end. And we'll do that once a month. We'll have a virtual meeting, and, you know, one of these days, that virtual meeting is going to occur on a Wednesday. Yeah, so when that happens, it's going to be very interesting because we'll be on the radio and on the Internet at the same time. That's something we want to try this year, getting BAI onto the net and getting things rolling as far as that kind of thing goes. All right. A couple other weird things happened over the past couple of weeks. I got to play with a MetroCard for the first time. Remember, we had this in the studio a few weeks ago. First MetroCard ever. And, you know, I had this MetroCard a few weeks ago, and what did I do right after the program? I went out and I used it. Or, no, correction is in order here. I tried to use it. Yeah, I went to a train station right here at 34th Street, 34th and 8th, and thought it would be a good idea to just, you know, put it in the machine and walk through, just as if we had always had a MetroCard system in this city. And, of course, it didn't work. And I had heard about this. I knew that a lot of New Yorkers are guilty of swiping too fast. So you have to swipe slowly. It's not like D.C. where you just put the card in and it sucks it up for you and does all kinds of neat things. No, it's not like that at all. You have to swipe it at the right speed and make the machine happy. So I swiped it. I swiped it slow. I swiped it fast. I swiped it stationary. I swiped it backwards and forwards and everything you could possibly imagine. It did not work. It did not work at all. And so, yeah, I looked at the person behind the desk there and just saw kind of a look of baffled confusion on their part. So, you know, I wasn't in the mood for this, having paid $5 for this card in the first place, so I did what any normal New Yorker would do. And I went right over the turnstile, which is incredible because I thought those turnstiles were supposed to prevent you from doing that, but it didn't. I just went right over the thing, and everybody there saw what I did. I made no bones about this. Everyone saw I was trying to pay. I was trying to use my card. It just wasn't recognizing it. It wasn't saying I didn't have any money. It wasn't recognizing it at all. It didn't work. The system was broken. Tried to pay, and it just didn't work, and nobody knew how to deal with it. So went over, and everybody pretty much agreed that was the thing to do, except for these two cops that were two platforms away. Now, the way that station is mapped out, you have one platform, then you have some tracks, another platform, some more tracks, and then another platform. And that's where they were, all the way on the other end. And they were sort of saying to me, you know, that's illegal what you just did. And we were having this long, extended conversation where I was explaining to them and waving my fare card and saying, look, it doesn't work, over four tracks and two platforms. And it got very difficult. And after a while, I just sort of, you know, gave up on the conversation and expected them to sort of go through the tunnel and arrest me, or maybe call up on the payphone next to me and yell at me a little bit more. But it never happened. I still have this fare card. I still haven't used it. I'm trying to use it. But for now, I have to say the system is terrible. The system does not work very well at all. We'll just have to experiment some more and see what happens. For one thing, on this card, there is no proof that I spent $5 on it. No proof at all. So when I walk up to somebody and say, hey, the system doesn't work, well, how are they going to believe me? How are they going to believe how much is on this card? I know there's $5 on it, but nobody else does. So it's not something I recommend, at least not now. Tokens, at least you know what you paid for them. All right, now to the prison news, which is always bad, of course. We do have an update from Fiber Optic, a.k.a. Mark. Actually, I guess I should say that the other way around. And then we'll be taking phone calls after that. Before we get into Fiber, I'd like to read you something that I got concerning another prisoner who, you know, as Scorpion, Paul Stira, who got into a bit of trouble because, well, first of all, his name showed up in 2600 Magazine, this issue, so that he would be able to get some mail. They didn't like that at all. They don't like it when people get lots of mail or get their names printed in magazines, but it was his choice, and we believe he has every right to do that. And he says he's getting mail at least one piece a day, and it's keeping his sanity, and that's the important thing. And I know that Fiber is getting mail, too, and that's keeping his sanity, and that's about all you can hope for when you're in prison. Listen to this letter that we got, though, from the Federal Bureau of Prisons. We sent Paul Scorpion a whole lot of copies of 2600 Magazine, because that's what he was interested in reading, and we thought it would make the days go by. Well, the prison people didn't agree, and they sent a letter to Paul saying the following. 21 incoming publications, 21, that's about all the ones we sent them, titled 2600, addressed to you, have been found to contain objectionable material. The decision has been made that this material would be detrimental to the security and good order of the institution. Specifically, the publications contain information which could possibly compromise the integrity of USP Lewisburg's computer operations. In view of the foregoing, the publications must be rejected as being a threat to the security and good order of the institution. The sender is being informed that the publications are being rejected. Now, they sent us a similar kind of a letter, along with a copy of that letter, telling us that we had every right to have an independent review. Now, here's the weird part. This happens every single time we have a problem with the prison system. The letter is dated January 12th. And in this letter, dated January 12th, they tell us we have 15 days to appeal this. However, the letter was mailed, and we know this from the postmark on the envelope, the letter was mailed on January 24th, 12 days after the letter was written. Now, the letter says you have 15 days from now to respond. Otherwise, the magazines will be sent back to you. So, obviously, they don't intend to let people actually respond. Now, this has happened to us before where we've had our magazine rejected and we sent this letter out, and both times they've dated the letter about 12 days before they send out the actual letter. So we'll see what happens. We'll see if they actually allow us to appeal, and if we can find out exactly what it is they find so objectionable in every single one of the issues that we sent out. I mean, we very rarely deal with prison systems or prison computers or anything like that. So we'll keep you updated on that. We also heard from another prisoner known as Acid Freak, who's generally doing all right. See, prisoners do have a lot of problems that we just don't think of. For instance, they're assigned a particular job, and they have to do this job every single day. Now, in at least one of these cases, one of our friends was stricken with the flu, and they were taken to the doctor, and the doctor said, get lots of rest. And the warden said, you have to go to work, and you can't get lots of rest. And so these people have to go to work when they're sick in bed, when they have the flu, when they have fevers of 101, they still have to do their job, so to say, as important as it might be. So that's the kind of thing we're dealing with here, the stupidity of the bureaucracy. All right. No further ado, let's listen to Fiber Optic, see how he's doing, and then we'll take some phone calls at 212-279-3400.
So, Mark, how are things working out for you over there in the prison?
Well, I'm trying to adjust as best I can, and I'm hanging around with some good people. See, the important thing is talking with people. There's some good, friendly people here, despite what one might think. And a lot of the time I'll just sit around and smoke cigarettes and chat with people, and it helps the time go easier rather than just keeping to yourself and going crazy.
What kind of people are there with you?
There's people here of all ages, from like late teens to like 70s. And people are here for assorted reasons. There's people here for embezzlement, financial crimes, and there's people here for small amounts of drug possession, too.
Can you describe what a typical day consists of?
It depends. But basically, there's something like about 5 counts every day. And one of those, the one at 415, is a formal count where you actually have to be in your cube. And the other one is basically you just be in one of the TV rooms or in your cube. It doesn't matter. It's an informal count. And so you're constantly aware of the counts during the course of the day. And might be watching some TV, or if you bother to get up at 6 in the morning, you might eat breakfast. So the meals are at very odd times, and I have a lot of trouble dealing with it. Because breakfast is at 6 a.m., lunch is at 10:45, and dinner is right after the 4:15 count. So, like, unless you actually buy food in the commissary, you're going to be hungry a lot of the time.
Now, what kind of things are they making you do as far as any kind of job or chore or things like that?
Yeah, the job I got assigned is in a place called the Powerhouse. And it's basically where there's gas. They use natural gas to heat the buildings and to heat for hot water and stuff. So I'm thinking of changing it because it's horribly noisy there, and there's all these caustic chemicals laying around that make me really nervous. And basically, I have to. I don't have to. I'm there with like a couple other people, but I read gauges. I basically read meters. The meters have to be read once an hour and logged.
So that's about as close to technology as you get, eh?
Yeah, pretty much.
Are you getting much mail?
Yeah, I appreciate all the mail I've been receiving, and books and magazines and stuff, too. It's been keeping me in good spirits, so much so that I look forward to getting mail. It's like the high point of the day is mail call, because I've pretty much gotten mail every day. So it's something to look forward to. It's sort of, you know, my tie back home. Sort of my connection to the real world, so to speak.
Yeah, I guess a lot of other people don't have that good fortune.
Yeah.
Now, can you just clear one thing up? There's a lot of talk as to what exactly happened after we dropped you off that time. Can you just tell us exactly what did happen?
Well, it wasn't very pleasant. I got strip searched, and all my what little property I had on me was taken away, including my clothing and things. And apparently what they didn't inform us when we called on the phone was that no one is here to process you on the weekend if you're a new inmate. So they threw me in segregation, which is better known as the hole. And it was pretty miserable for about a day and a half. And you're basically alone in a small cell with the bed and one of these stainless steel combination sink toilet things that freezes your ass when you flush the toilet, because there's no toilet seat or anything. And a piece of polished metal, which I would assume is supposed to be a mirror, and little else, that's about it.
No windows?
There's something that resembles a window with thick metal bars on it, and you have a nice view of the barbed wire fence right outside with the spotlight.
I see. And how long were you in there for?
About a day and a half, until Monday morning. This was pretty much the whole weekend.
And did they tell you why they were putting you there?
Not specifically, no.
So what happened after that?
On Monday morning, when I was still there, when I got up, I tried to eat some breakfast, and the food down there was incredibly bad. And whether it was nerves or just, well, I'm sure it was nerves, and a combination of that and just bad food and stuff, I just puked all over the place right before I left. So it was good that I got that out of my system.
And also sort of left behind a calling card of sorts, I guess.
Yeah, basically. So then they took me out, and they gave me a change of clothing. It was more suited for where I was going, and they pretty much drove me up the road, and I checked in here. And then what happened at night was I had a serious nervous attack or anxiety attack, whatever you want to call it, and I just felt really faint, and I was getting like pins and needles and like cramps in my hands and arms and stuff, and I felt like I was going to pass out just from stress. So a bunch of guys, like, they called one of the guards, and they helped me down to the doctor. And the doctor gave me something to calm me down, some liquid sedative or something. And I kind of felt better after that. And it was then that I came to realize that people were generally friendly. You know, there's sort of this camaraderie almost between a lot of the inmates. Like, they'll help you out and show you the ropes and sort of get you going and try to alleviate your stress and stuff, because everyone pretty much just wants to go home too. And the majority of people don't want any trouble with anyone else because they don't want to get into trouble and get thrown in the hole for violence or anything like that.
Uh-huh. Now, is there any kind of disciplinary thing that you have to abide by? I know you have to keep your cubicle clean.
Yeah, there's that. There's basically not interfering with any of the counts, which can be a severe thing. There's being careful about what you talk about on the phone, because they're obviously monitored. and they record everything.
Do they say what we're not supposed to talk about?
It's never really been specific. What they have said is that they don't want you to carry business, to carry on business over the phone. So basically, one of the reasons they got this inmate telephone system was that people were just, you know, running illegal rackets out of prison. So they pretty much spoiled it for everyone. And they don't want people conducting business over the phone.
Can you very quickly describe the phone system, how it works?
Well, basically, we're all assigned 9-digit PAC codes, phone access codes. And the first, you have to submit a list of a maximum of 20 phone numbers, which you're authorized to call. And that's it. And as soon as they get activated, which can take anywhere from a couple of days to a couple of weeks, then for the first 7 days, when you first get here and your phone is activated, your PAC code, you can make collect calls only and only to those numbers. And after that 7-day period is expired, you have to make sure that if you came in with money, then that's good. You could put phone credits. When you go to the commissary, you can put phone credits in $1 increments towards your phone usage. And local calls, local, as far as like calling New York and surrounding states, it's roughly 23 cents a minute.
And you only have a 15-minute limit, is that right?
15 limit for every call.
In fact, we're fast approaching that right now.
You get a 1-minute warning, and then your call is terminated.
Uh-huh.
And you can check your balance when it works. I was saying before, I just tried to check my balance, and nothing happened.
Uh-huh.
The phone system is rather poor and unreliable at best.
Uh-huh. Now, we have to, of course, keep you supplied in phone credits by sending money orders to you so that you're able to call us back.
Yeah, that and so I can shop at the commissary.
Right.
Pretty much to buy food and cigarettes.
And you get to do that once a week.
Yeah, once a week I can do that.
Okay, we'll get out the information as to how exactly to do that. We're about to get cut off in about a minute or so. Is there anything else that you wanted to say to people out there?
Just that I'm doing okay, and I look forward to the day when I could be back there in the studio and tell everyone my story.
When do you think that day is? Have they given you an exact...
Okay.
That's the warning. We have a one-minute warning. We'll get one more warning, I think, when there's 10 seconds left.
Yeah.
Did they give you an idea when that date is?
Yeah, it's probably going to be sometime in November, if not sooner, like if I manage to get a halfway house, which I don't know if I'll accept or not, if I even get it. It's not very good. But I get something like 54 days off for good behavior, so it would fall sometime in November.
Seems so far away.
November, yeah.
But we'll be literally counting the days.
Okay.
And they're literally counting the seconds. All right, well, it's always good talking to you.
Okay.
And we'll be in touch with you again real soon. Hello?
For you whose eyes were open wide, wise mind refused to see. I'm sore in need of saving grace. Yeah. Be kind and humor me. I'm lost amid the sea of weeds, where people speak.
And you are listening to Off the Hook here on WBAI New York. We're just listening to Fiber Optic, an interview from prison in Schuylkill. In fact, we're going to give out his address right now and urge our listeners that recognize the sound of his voice and have learned a thing or two from him in the past to take a little bit of time and write to him, because, as he said, mail call is probably the highlight of the day. And you never know how important that is until you're either in the army or in a prison somewhere. It's an interesting parallel, and I'm sure it's been drawn before. Okay, this is the address. Please write it down and let other people know about it as well. Name is Mark, M-A-R-K, Abdene, that's A-B-E-N-E. And on the same line, because right now that is part of his name, the number is 32109-054. 32109-054. And on the next line, FPC, as in Federal Prison Camp, comma, Schuylkill, which is spelled S-C-H-U-Y-L-K-I-L-L. And next line, Unit 1. Next line, P.O. Box 670. And finally, Minersville, that's M-I-N-E-R-S-V-I-L-L-E, Pennsylvania, zip code 17954-0670. And again, if you can, if it's possible, to contribute to the, I guess, phone account or commissary account or what have you, so that he'd be able to keep in touch with us and others as well, and buy things in the commissary. Once a week he gets to go to the commissary and buy things. And of course, it's kind of like being in the village, you know, in the prisoner, where you buy things that you've never heard of before, that are only made in one particular part of the world and are probably inferior to what you're used to. But it's a privilege. You can only do it once a week, and you can only do it if you have money in your account. So if you want to contribute to his account, send a money order to that same address, and address put on the name of the money order, his full name plus the prisoner number. And that way, you will ensure that his life will be a little bit easier. Okay, let's take some phone calls. 212-279-3400. That's our telephone number. And we're talking about, about this sad aspect of the whole hacker world. And as well as other forms of technology that we've been talking about before. The carrier access code is going to be changing. New York City is being met with a new system of mass transit. It's going to be an interesting next couple of, months, years, what have you. It's going to be interesting, that's for sure. So stay tuned to Off the Hook. We'll be bringing you information as we get it. 212-279-3400 is our phone number.
1 p.m. and after lunch from 2.
I don't know what that is. Okay, let's pick up this line. Good morning.
Hello, is this on the hook?
I mean, good afternoon. No, good evening. Yeah, I'm in the right place. Go ahead.
I just had a couple of questions.
Yeah.
Let's say a BBS caller decided that, like a long distance caller decided to set up an 800 or reroute an 800 number to the BBS, and because he was kind of paying long-distance calls, and a lot of people used it, and the number spread around, would the system operator be liable?
This sounds like a hypothetical question, and I hope it is. Would the system operator be liable? Well, it depends. Did the system operator know about this? Was the system operator part of this alleged conspiracy?
No.
Well, then how could he be liable? If you route an 800 number to somebody's house, and people call that person at the house... Well, no, they have no knowledge of it, so they're not liable. And I've seen this kind of thing happen before, where people route things that are popular through 800 numbers, and it's not a legal thing to do, obviously, if nobody intends on paying for those calls.
System operator wouldn't be liable.
Well, no, because the billing number is not the same as the end number in this case. It used to be that 800 numbers always routed to the billing number. But these days, you can have an 800 number route any place you want. In fact, I'm still waiting, and I said this a couple of years ago, I'm still waiting for a rich person somewhere to route an 800 number to the White House so that people can call the White House for free and the rich person would pay the bill. Hasn't happened yet. But, no, the person is not liable unless they're part of that particular plan. The person who is liable, though, is the person that set up the service and the person who provided billing information. And
if it was set up from a payphone with all false information, that no one would pretty much no one would.
Well, if a phone company is dumb enough to actually accept information from a payphone that's fake, then I guess the phone company is the one that winds up being liable.
And also, one other question: what's up with that free phone thing? I've heard a lot about it. I called up, but is it bogus or is it real? They really just make calls.
You'll have to describe the system to me.
It was listed in the latest 2600 magazine. I believe Whistler wrote the letter. And what it was a service, I believe it was in New Jersey, that you call up. And from what they said, you hook up with their service, so you dial a carrier access code for them before you dial the number. And any number you dial using their access code, they pay you. They give you money back for dialing the numbers.
Yeah, that's something that I'm very doubtful of. And it's the only way to really know if something like that is on the level is to try it out. And I just haven't gotten around to trying that one out yet. You're welcome to do it and see what happens.
Because I heard on the 2600 bulletin board, they said that they taped the conversations too, all the conversations.
I kind of doubt that.
Yeah, from what I hear, it's running. The whole system's running off of a 486.
Pretending to be someone else and how easy it was. Been an incident here at my house where I'm sure the person's listening right now. They basically called up the cable company, phone company, electricity company, all that, and said, we're moving. Could you turn off all these services? And we were not aware at all that they had done this until the next morning. I happened to notice that nor the cable or the phones were working. And sure enough, I called up. And what they had done is, for the phone company, they had somehow put a recording on, got them to put a recording on that said the number's been changed.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a different number, and if you called that number, it didn't even work. So I don't know how they couldn't have figured that out. And then they had disconnected the cable, sent all our bills to totally different locations. And the strange thing was, we then put a passcode on our account, which you can do with 9X now. If you can put a 3-digit access code on it, where no changes can be made without it.
That's right.
Well, sure enough, I called up to order three-way calling. They didn't ask for the access code after we had put it in.
Incredible. And you know what else? There's another weakness in that system where you can assign an access code to somebody else that doesn't have one.
Exactly.
And thereby lock them out of their own account.
And the last thing is, you're talking about how there's a number shortage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, two things about that. First of all, I got a tour of the local 9X office here, the switching office. If you want to happen to do that, they'll give you a free tour or whatever. Just first of all, call 914-890-2300 for the president's helpline, and just tell them, you're doing a project or something,
mm-hmm.
curious about the system, and you want to know if you could get a tour, and they'll usually be happy to do that, and they'll give you a tour.
Don't mention 2600 Magazine, don't mention Off the Hook, and you'll probably get in.
Yeah. What they told me was, well, two things. First of all, they're saying they have I'm not sure maybe if this will change the problem, but first of all, they have a way of sending two phone lines through one copper wire, not fiber optics, but copper.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing was, they told me that only 35,000 out of the 70,000 numbers here, at least, are used, and they don't plan to use the rest of them because they might need them for emergencies.
Well,
everywhere,
uh-huh.
They don't need the new area because that's just a waste.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of wasted numbers, I guess you could look at it through cellular phones, voicemail boxes, beepers, things like that, things that aren't real, true phone lines, and that's why we're running out of numbers. But they're only numbers, We can simply assign other things. This area code change is something that's long overdue.
There's one prefix here where you can call it, and it says, call answering cannot continue, transferring to an attendant, and about 5,000 numbers.
Wow. Well, there's all kinds of weird things going on.
Yeah.
And it's going to increase for the next couple of years. I don't know what's going to happen after that.
Yeah.
All right, thanks for your call. That reminds me. It reminds me of something else weird that happened over the past couple of weeks. A lot has happened in these last few weeks since we've been on. We had a problem with the phone company where they actually turned off one of our phone lines. I mean, this has never, ever, ever happened before. But you know what they do these days? When they turn off your phone line, it used to be that you would pick up the phone and you wouldn't get anything. You would not get a dial tone. You could still get incoming calls, but you wouldn't get a dial tone. You couldn't dial anything. And in fact, there was a trick. There might even still be a trick with that particular system. The trick being that that you can somehow get three-way, if you have three-way, if you subscribe to three-way, that is, you can manage to get another dial tone by having somebody call you, and then you flash the switch hook and you go to another dial tone. That dial tone will be unrestricted. Now, there's another way of doing things. That's the way they do things today. They have the more sophisticated way of doing it. That's where you get a dial tone, but you can't dial anything. They don't let you dial anything. You can only call an 890 number, which is New York Telephone, or a 911. That's it. You get a recording saying, to call the police, dial 911 to talk about your bill, call us. Actually, you can call 800 numbers, too. So it was a mistake. It was a clerical error, and we were able to get it fixed pretty quickly. But we had enough time to hack out the system and see if there were any holes in it, and we were unable to find anything. Unable to find a single hole, except for 800 numbers going through. 950s did not work at all. 958 worked. 958 and 511 worked for the automatic number announcements. And 311, the new TDD service, worked. So that was kind of neat right there. Okay. 212-279-3400. Good evening. You're on.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Am I on the air?
Yes.
Hello. I was out. Who's this? I just stumbled on your program. You're talking about the earthquake.
No, you got the wrong station. Sorry. Good morning. I mean, good evening.
Hi. Are you on a delay or am I on the air?
You're on the air. And we're not talking about an earthquake.
I beg your pardon? What am I? Oh, I see. I am on the air. Anyway, let me turn this down. Okay. Here's my question. What can you tell me about non-published numbers? Getting them, the legalities, ways of, if you do get those numbers, what is legal to know and what's not legal to know?
I'm sorry?
Did you follow?
I'm sorry, I had trouble hearing you.
Okay, my question is about non-published numbers.
Yes.
What is possible to get? What is not possible to get? If you get those numbers, are you holding illegal information, et cetera?
If you get a non... Well, I don't know what you mean by if you get a non-published number.
Well, I guess through surreptitious means, you could get a non-published number of someone else's.
Well, then it's the method.
The process that you got that. Knowing that information, do you think that would be illegal?
I think disseminating that information would be illegal. I don't think actually having the information in itself is illegal. But certainly, if you were to break a law to get the information, then yes, you'd be breaking a law, obviously.
Right.
But that's you know, possession, unlike what they sent fiber optic away for, it's not holding on to an access device. It's not holding on to an access device. It's basically, you know...
Information.
Yeah, it's information.
Well, do you have... Now, the next question becomes, if there was a method by dialing 12345, hypothetically, and there's an internal code that one can use to get that information, knowing that information, if such a thing existed, and then starting to use it, would that be illegal? If there was a way to hack into it, if there was a legal way that you found a way to get into a system, you happened upon some information that allowed you to go into computers and pull it,
But you're still violating the person's privacy by getting it in the first place, and that's, you know, that's subject to something. Mm-hmm. You see, and that's where breaking a law would come in. You know, violating somebody's privacy, getting information that's supposed to be private. Now, if that information is made available by phone companies and made available easily by phone companies, well, then that's something that the phone companies should answer for.
Interesting.
You see.
All right, well...
And it's not uncommon. This is happening a lot, unless the numbers are getting out quite a bit.
Now, the most important question is, do you know how to get them?
Do I know how to get them? There are ways of getting them. Yes, I don't. I'm not going to.
Like to say on the air.
No, I don't believe in spreading that kind of information where people's numbers can actually be compromised. There are definitely lots and lots of tricks, and as you can hear by the intelligence level of some of the people working the phone companies, it's not hard to get them to tell you things they're not supposed to.
Right.
It's very hard to get them to tell you things they are supposed to, but that's something else.
All right.
Thanks for calling.
That's all I wanted to ask about.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
See if we can squeeze in one more call. Good evening.
Yeah, good evening. I would like to know two questions. Where in Manhattan can I get the 2600, and how is the prisoner, poor Mark, going to know that he has money coming his way?
First of all, I know Mark is going to love the fact that he's not referred to as the prisoner. He is going to like that.
Hi, Mark, I'm saying.
No, I like it. I think he will, too. But basically, how is he going to know? Well, hopefully, he dials a particular number to find out what his balance is on, I think, both the phone and the commissary.
Right.
In case those of you are curious out there, the number is 118. That's what he dials him inside his system. And he's able to tell on a day-by-day basis how much money is put into there. And I think he would also find out who it's from. I'm pretty sure that's how it works. He hasn't been in there long enough for us to really know how that system works. I should be talking to him in the next couple of days, and I can find out more specifics about that.
Somebody who didn't know him were to send him $10 or something, and the person, of course, money order or whatever, and has the proof, but he never finds out because somebody else uses it or whatever.
I know it's hard for us to trust these people that run the prison, but we're going to have to for this particular thing.
Right.
But, you know, a contribution like that of $10 would have paid for the interview you just heard now, you know,
right.
Things like that. And we cannot call him. It's really sad that we can't call back and ask questions. We have to wait for him to call us. We have to be around just at that particular moment. And after 15 minutes, he gets cut off.
I would gladly, for example, send the copy of the money order to somewhere where then he has a proof or something.
Uh-huh.
Because of me, but because for him... to have the possibility of double-checking if he has received something.
Okay, well, you're welcome to send it here to BAI as well.
Uh-huh.
Or if you want, we can forward it to him. That's fine as well.
Uh-huh.
If you
send it in a letter, would it get to him, that the copy that something has been sent to him?
Yeah, we would make sure of that.
I know. I mean, because I have a feeling that he's very appreciated and that this might come up through other people also.
Uh-huh.
Will he know if he has received something, not for an ego trip, but just for him to know that he has something coming or that something was sent, to be able to double check?
See, we really don't know yet. We really don't know.
Okay.
We have to try.
And where in Manhattan could I find a 2600? I would like to have a sample copy to buy it to read before I subscribe.
Try any kind of alternative bookstore or places like Tower or Hudson News or places like that.
Okay, wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
All right, we're out of time here. It's just about 11 o'clock, time for us to be rebroadcasting the news. If you want to send something to the radio station and not to the prison, or if you want to send a duplicate to us so we can verify if Fiber ever got it, you can write to us here at WBAI, Emmanuel Goldstein, Off the Hook, 505 8th Avenue, New York, New York, 10018. We'll be back next week with yet another fun-filled edition of Off the Hook. And until then, stay happy, stay educated, stay warm. Good night.
Good evening. In the news tonight, a congressional task force studies homelessness and leans toward long-term solutions. The third Clinton nominee for civil rights comes under conservative attacks. And in New York, the mayor's new budget calls for significant cuts, while the Con Edison company is charged with racial discrimination. With these and other stories, I'm Jose Santiago in New York with Verna Avery Brown in Washington, and this is the news for Wednesday, February 2nd, 1994. First to Washington for the Pacifica National News.
The British media today reported that Gerry Adams' entry into the United States has ended the special relationship between the two countries. Gerry Adams is the leader of Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA. Adams has used his presence in the United States to gain access to the type of media attention he is denied in Britain. He appeared on more than a dozen TV interviews and was greeted by hundreds of Irish Americans in a packed New York hotel last night. Adams has taken every opportunity to call for renewed peace talks with the British government. But the British government has criticized Adams for gaining publicity without making any commitments to nonviolence. The State Department responded to the British media reports by saying the special relationship between the two countries still existed. President Clinton said today that he was seriously considering doing what was right in relations with America's former enemy, Vietnam. While a formal decision would be announced in the next few days, a senior administration official said it was virtually certain that the trade embargo would be lifted. Last week, the Senate voted 62-38 to lift the embargo. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said today that Israel and the PLO were still weeks away from reaching an agreement. The statement came one day after PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat said that he hoped to sign an accord with Israel next week. Arafat was also quoted as saying that the PLO was no longer insisting on an independent state. Today, leaders of the Radical Palestinians Alliance condemned Arafat's supposed statements. Also today, the Israeli army has imposed a curfew on the West Bank town of Hebron after an outbreak of more violence. The army is hunting for suspected Palestinian gunmen after the shooting of three Jewish settlers early today. In Germany, a walkout by tens of thousands of workers in the country's crucial engineering sector is causing alarm in government circles. Alexa Dvorsen has this report from Cologne.
The 90,000 steel workers who joined the warning strikes today added their voice to push engineering employers to grant a 6% wage increase. Leaders of Germany's most powerful union, IG Metall, say they would accept any concession by employers that would guarantee job security. According to the unions, the wage freezes and cuts in benefits proposed amount to a real pay cut of 10%. But employers say plunging order levels and weak profits mean a wage freeze is the only way to save jobs and cut costs. One executive says a strike to push through unrealistic cost increases is socially irresponsible. Meanwhile, economists warn a full strike in the metal sector could wreck all growth forecasts as Germany limps out of recession. For Pacifica Network News, this is Alexa Dvorsen in Cologne.
Defense Secretary nominee William Perry said today that the United States aims to prevent North Korea from building more nuclear weapons, but hopes not to use force. Perry was appearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee on the first day of his confirmation hearings to be Defense Secretary. A report from the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies today says a record number of African Americans served as elected public officials last year. The report numbered 8,015 blacks serving in 1993 compared to 7,552 the year before. The center attributed the gains partly to the redrawing of district lines at the state, local, and congressional levels, and partly to the enforcement of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. In 1965, just 280 African Americans served as elected officials. In Texas, the first execution of the year went ahead today. At 12:27 local time, Harold Bernard was pronounced dead 9 minutes after receiving a lethal dose of chemicals. Bernard was convicted of the murder of a 16-year-old convenience store clerk in a 1980 robbery. He was the 72nd person to die in Texas since the death penalty was restored in 1980 and the 222nd in the United States since 1976. And those are the stories topping the news. Another battle may be brewing over the third nominee for head of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. The president withdrew the other two nominees under political fire, and just one day after the name was announced, one conservative has already begun taking verbal potshots. Pacifica's Don Rush reports.
His name is Deval Patrick, and he's a corporate lawyer who once worked for the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund during the 1980s. And civil rights advocates hailed the choice to head up the Civil Rights Division in the U.S. Justice Department. Ralph Neese, head of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights.
Deval Patrick brings extraordinary qualifications to the job. He certainly has exceptional civil rights and legal credentials, and because of those qualifications, I personally am quite confident that he will be confirmed in the Senate by a very substantial bipartisan majority.
But the issues that sank the nomination of Lonnie Guinier, who also worked for the Legal Defense Fund, are already coming into play. Indeed, Clint Bolick with the Conservative Institute for Justice published his first broadside against Patrick this morning, less than 24 hours after the announcement. And civil rights advocates expressed concern that the White House responds strongly to any criticism of Patrick as the nomination makes its way through the U.S. Senate. Julia Malvo, a syndicated columnist, put it this way.
If he doesn't come out strong, I think we're going to be in danger. I think the president has to make it clear that he stands firmly behind this nominee. There should be no wavering whatsoever. He should do the kind of handling for Deval Patrick that was done for Ruth Bader Ginsburg and et cetera.
In the first attack by conservatives, Bolick with the Institute for Justice charges that both Guinier and Patrick hold a common belief that unconscious racism permeates American society and can only be removed through race-conscious social engineering. Bolick focuses in on the 1987 McCleskey death penalty case. In that case, Patrick sought to get the death penalty ruled unconstitutional by demonstrating through the use of statistics an adverse impact on blacks. This results-oriented solution, says Bolick, puts Patrick out of the mainstream. But Ted Shaw with the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund says there is no prohibition from using such figures to further the argument of intentional discrimination in constitutional cases. And he notes the Supreme Court turned back Patrick's efforts by a 5-4 decision.
The Supreme Court didn't deny the truth of that study. In fact, the majority opinion might have tried to express some skepticism, but said whatever that study might show. We aren't going to second-guess juries.
Yesterday, the president said he disagreed with the NAACP's position on the death penalty. And civil rights groups played down the significance of such positions. Shaw was an example.
I think Deval Patrick understands the difference between being a lawyer for the Legal Defense Fund, in which you're pushing the law and representing clients, and being the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, in which the government is your client.
But there are doubts that the Senate is ready for another bruising battle. Clarence Page with the Chicago Tribune.
I think the real telling sign of this attack on Deval Patrick for his association with the Legal Defense Fund is an attack of buzzwords and guilt by association as Clint Bolick and other conservatives try to portray Bill Clinton as an advocate of quotas, busing, and all the other buzzwords that have hurt Democrats politically with a number of fearful white voters. I don't think that's going to work this time, though. I don't think the Senate Judiciary Committee wants to see another show trial of the sort they had with Clarence Thomas or Robert Bork.
It should be noted that Clint Bolick refused to talk with Pacifica Network News. Don Rush, Pacifica Network News, Washington.
Home sales shot up 9.7% last year. In fact, in 1993, new homes sold faster than at any time in the past 5 years. That's good news for the economy, but it won't mean much to people without homes, people living on the street. What may ultimately have more effect on them, however, is that a congressional task force on homelessness has released their final report on recommendations to the Clinton administration. Mark Beavis reports.
Another congressional task force with yet another report on homelessness. It's got numbers, it's got statistics. But advocates for the homeless are saying this one's different. They're calling it a big step forward. Fred Karnas is with the National Coalition for the Homeless.
Any report is just a report until somebody makes it happen, and obviously one of our roles is going to be to press for some of the changes that they're recommending, and hopefully, I mean, Congressman Vento has been a leader in this, and hopefully he will be able to push some of it forward.
The reason this one's different is because it concentrates on long-term solutions. Until now, most federal efforts have focused on short-term emergency aid through legislation like the McKinney Act. That legislation, originally passed in 1987 and scheduled to be reauthorized this year, spends more than $1 billion on emergency shelters, soup kitchens, transitional housing, and emergency health programs.
Homelessness is not a short-term phenomenon. It's a long-term problem that our country is experiencing. It's important that we begin to deal with the streams that are feeding that problem rather than try to intercept them at the waterfall.
Minnesota Democratic Representative Bruce Vento, chair of the nine-member task force.
The information that we've gathered shows that 7% of the people in this country actually experiencing homelessness at some time in their life. If you begin to add in the numbers of those that live with family and friends, you can almost double that number of people that are experiencing that. And that phenomena is increasing because of the vulnerability of people in our economy, an economy that's going through restructuring.
Notice the task force actually faulted the economy, not like President Reagan when he spoke of people living on the street because they want to. Task force member Representative Lucian Blackwell, Democrat from Pennsylvania.
There's nothing mysterious about homelessness. We need jobs with livable wages, we need affordable housing, and we need national health care to take care of those people who need it. We have to take care of Americans. Americans should not be sleeping on the streets. There's something evil about that, something wrong with that, and we need to stop it today.
The task force calls for a livable minimum wage. It says $4.25 an hour is not enough. It calls for reforming the income support programs such as AFDC, food stamps, and WIC to address the specific needs of homeless people. The task force also emphasized health care, education, and job training reform. Members of the task force stressed the necessity of having federal agencies working together to solve the problem of homelessness, and representatives from several agencies attended the report's release. Andrew Cuomo is Assistant Housing Secretary.
We have to go through the entire report because it has recommendations that have ramifications on many different agencies. But the premise of the report, I think, is in line with the thinking that you see coming out of the White House, which says we need more of a comprehensive system, we have to get more discretion down to the local level, and we have to do more before people become homeless, because once they become homeless, it's too late.
The report was sent off to the president today. Despite the urgency of the problem, members of Congress are not planning any formal legislative package around the recommendations. As one congressional staff member said, it will be more of a piecemeal approach. Fred Karnas with the National Coalition for the Homeless.
I'll hold my optimism until I see what happens next. I mean, I think we're operating in an environment where there's a lot of talk about limited resources and networking and linking together, which you always hear when there's no money. And a lot of that can help, but we have to have money to really make some things happen, particularly as we talk about affordable housing.
Mark Beavis, Pacifica Network News, Washington.
The number of homeless people in this country has risen dramatically over the last two decades, but it's not a new phenomena. Unfortunately, homelessness is as American as the little frame house with the white picket fence. In fact, it was a lack of affordable housing, along with a host of other social ills, that helped spawn one of the most militant political action groups in America, the Black Panthers. David Hilliard is one of the founding members of the Black Panther Party. He's the author of a book titled This Side of Glory. The book, says Hilliard, gives him a chance to record his version for history.
We were an organization trying to make life better for blacks in the area of jobs and education. And primarily, our organization was always a political organization with a political agenda, actually a 10-point program. That we get very little focus on. And as you opened the discussion, you know, saying that we were a violent militant organization, quite the contrary. We were a self-defense organization.
What I said was that many people may associate violence and militancy with the organization. However, I remember that the original goals had a lot to do with nonviolence
exactly.
And politics.
We were a self-defense organization, and the guns were really only one manifestation of our self-defense program. We also define self-defense against inadequate health care systems and self-defense against unemployment, which gave rise to our quest for our full employment for our people that is spelled out in our 10-point program and free food programs, which I helped initiate in our Breakfast for Children program in 1968. So we were a political organization who believed in our right to self-defense.
There are reports of new armed Black Panther organizations in at least 20 cities across the U.S. Are you personally aware of them? Do you have any input into them?
Well, I'm aware of the resurgence of Panther chapters. One in particular I hear is in Dallas, Texas, called the New Black Panther Party. But I have not been apprised of any organizations who are talking, who are actually running around patrolling police with armed weapons. And personally, I'm not involved with any of those groups. But I do think that there's a need for a resurgence of the Black Panther Party, you know, in our youth to carry forth our unfinished agenda spelled out in our 10-point program, because there's still homelessness and there's a need for jobs, and certainly there's a need for organizations to put an end to black-on-black violence. I think that people should do it, but certainly I do not advocate armed resistance against a United States government that will do to black folks many times over what they saw happen to the Davidians in Texas. It is absolutely homicidal, it's suicide to talk about an armed rebellion against this government. That's absolutely insane.
Do you think that history has been fair to how the Black Panthers has been portrayed?
No, I think that we've been portrayed as gangsters, that we were gun-toting youth who really had no political agenda. It is only because of my book, Elaine Brown's book, A Taste of Power, that we have the occasion to define our own history. I like to think that this is our our moment of definition. This is our time to tell our own story, left up to the biographers, FBI, which is where most of you get your knowledge from, through the COINTELPRO documents, through police information. You get a very slanted view, even the most well-meaning journalist.
What is the story that in your opinion, has not been told? This is an opportunity for you to share that with us.
Well, it has not been made clear that we were a political organization and that our agenda was one of self-defense, that what we were asking for were things spelled out in the Constitution, that we had an economic development agenda that called for those things that I outlined earlier. We were armed because we were a self-defense organization, but the guns were only one manifestation of what we considered our right to self-defense. And I don't pick any bones about that.
Mm-hmm.
We were being killed, as blacks are now, and the police were just running rampant throughout our communities in a state of lawlessness, and we had a right to defend our lives, and that's what we were about. But in the final analysis, we were not about unprovoked attacks against the police. We were about trying to carry forth our political agenda.
David Hilliard of the Black Panther Party.
You're listening to the WBAI Evening News. I'm Jose Santiago in New York. In local news, Mayor Giuliani today proposed a $31.2 billion city budget for the new fiscal year beginning July 1st. The plan is the first shot in the mayor's quest to close a projected $2.3 billion budget gap. And as predicted, he wants labor to bear the brunt of those cuts. David Sears has the story.
New York City has a bigger budget than all but two states. Today, Mayor Giuliani proposed reducing the amount the city will spend next year to $500 million less than the current budget. Giuliani says the problem is city government is just too large, and without firm action to reduce costs now, the budget gap could grow to $3.3 billion by 1998. His plan to permanently reduce the city government's workforce.
What we have to do is to downsize the city workforce by about 30,000 to 35,000 over a four-year period, and that we should try to do it with attrition, with encouraging attrition, and also, where necessary, with layoffs. We think we have come up with a way that can accelerate that, make it happen earlier, and then possibly reduce some of the pain and difficulties of it in later years if we can do it quickly enough.
Reducing the pain in this case means getting $200 million from the Municipal Assistance Corporation to offer a severance pay, inducing workers to leave government. Giuliani wants to reduce the city payroll by 8,000 workers by July 1st, and he says he's already identified about 5,500 jobs.